fail.
Yeah, I'm like really trying to
come on. Just get more pressure in, goddamn. Yeah.
Somebody can just start it out.
Yeah, yes, you okay. Can. All right, so
it's loud out here today. Thank you.
So good afternoon, good morning to everyone. Of course, I'm Tyrona Clark Murray. It's good to see everyone because my thought was like, no one will show up. That was my greatest fear this morning. It's like no one will show up, but I'm so glad to see all of you here. So the purpose, I'm being real because, you know, sometimes it happens, you know. So the purpose is to inform everyone as to the appeals process. I know many of my council colleagues that they are unfamiliar with the process because they're new. And so just to the perspective, not so much from the specific appeals that we are going to encounter on Tuesday, but looking at the entire process and giving an opportunity to ask questions of our experts. Of course, you know, Mary Stapopoulos and Jason Teal and Aaron Abney. That's right. I know everybody's name. And Aramis, right? So you can ask the experts any questions that you have so that you can make an informed decision. Because it's I keep trying to emphasize in my tenure that how important land use and zoning is. And it's like people don't get it until there's a decision made and they're like, oh, so that affects this. It's affecting that. So that's the purpose behind this. And I thank the four of you so much for being a part of our panel and the fact that you're going to inform us today. So thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here as well. And the start time for the record is 11:34. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Hey, I'll get us started. So we're a smaller group today, so we can take it a little more informally, if that's okay with you, Councilmember Clark Murray. And so as you think of questions while we present, feel free to go ahead and ask them. No need to save them to the end. So we're going to Jason and I are going to kind of start us out, and then we're going to kick it over to the planning department folks, Aaron and Aramis, to allow them to kind of talk more about when they receive an application, what does their analysis entail, and what all are they looking at when they're developing their staff report and their recommendation, which, as all of you are aware, is an important part of any land use and zoning application that comes through, whether it's an appeal or a zoning exception or a rezoning or a flume amendment. So they'll talk a little bit more about that, and then we'll bring it back to me and Jason. So as the councilwoman explained, there are two appeals that are currently pending that are going to come to council on Tuesday. We are not going to speak to either of those appeals because they are pending. But what we can do is speak to some prior appeals and our general process to be able to answer questions so everybody can feel more confident going into next Tuesday or in any meeting where we might be considering an item on appeal. So there were some handouts up at the front desk. I think all of you grabbed those. One was the land use and quasi-judicial proceedings. That outline came out of the council members' orientation manual, and it was just to give you all an additional copy to have at your fingertips if you wanted to refer to it. It goes a little bit more in depth into land use and rezoning applications in general. What is competent and substantial evidence? What is our standard of review? And we just thought it might be easy to have an additional copy at your fingertips. The other two items that we handed out were two memoranda, one with respect to an appeal that was received in 2022 on a final order of the Planning Commission on a waiver of minimum distance requirements for a liquor license location. And the other one was an appeal that was received earlier in March of 2023, and it was an appeal of a final order of the Jacksonville Historic Preservation Commission on a COA application. And so these memos are something that our office will do anytime you have an appeal that comes before the City Council. We will prepare this memorandum. Initially, we distribute it to the Land Use and Zoning Committee members because, as you're aware, that is the committee of reference to hear these types of matters. And prior to a hearing being opened on an appeal at Land Use and Zoning Committee, Jason or I, whoever is on the dais with the committee at that time, will go over the memo, which outlines what the appeal is about, what is the process for the hearing that would occur at the Land Use and Zoning Committee, and just as importantly or more importantly, what are the criteria that the committee and ultimately the council would be weighing when determining whether they want to grant the appeal, deny the appeal, you know, remand it back down for additional hearings, that kind of thing. And it also lists out what the options are for the Land Use and Zoning Committee to recommend and then ultimately for the council to take. So we'll go into those a little bit more. What typically then happens is we go through that with the Land Use and Zoning Committee, so they are confident in what that process is. They have their hearing, and then when it comes to council, we'll do kind of a Cliff's Notes version of this. We'll send out this memo to the full council so everybody has the benefit of the same information that the Land Use and Zoning Committee had. But then what we'll do is just do a shorter version to kind of prep the council when it's time for them to take action on an appeal so that they also have a good lay of the land going into their deliberations and vote. And so that I just kind of wanted to point out what our handouts are. There are a number of appeals that come to the city council that are land use and zoning related. Those are typically things that are ultimately initially decided by a lower group, Planning Commission and the Historic Preservation are the two that you think of the most. Anything that would come to council for a final action, a land use, a rezoning, certain types of zoning exceptions, those don't get appealed to council, obviously, because you're the final decision maker in that process. But there are a number of things where you are not the final decision maker. Waivers of liquor distance, there's a number of waivers, other waivers in the code, zoning exceptions, things like that that don't come to council for action. Those are the types of things that get appealed to city council. So that's why they don't tend, well, and as Mr. Boylan indicated earlier, you don't tend to see them all that often. The two that are pending are the only ones we've received in almost a year, and it can vary widely kind of how often you see them, but they don't happen very often. So I think this kind of workshop is good as just to kind of remind everybody what the process is, who's been through it, but it's been a minute, and to also educate our newer council members who just haven't had the opportunity to sit through this process. From there, Jason, if you want to add anything, please feel free.
Sure. So these are all quasi-judicial decisions. And so the good news is both of you understand what that means. For kind of the larger viewing audience, because they're quasi-judicial decisions, then that means that your decisions as council members have to be based on the record that's submitted to the council. You've assigned these kinds of matters to the Land Use and Zoning Committee, but that is the area where the public hearings are going to be held and those kinds of things, and that's what's the competent substantial evidence. Now, one of the things that you need to pay attention to is what is considered competent substantial evidence, or even more importantly, what is not considered competent substantial evidence. So what competent substantial evidence is it's evidence that tends to be relevant to the question that's being asked. And it has to be based upon the criteria that are laid out in the zoning code or the historic preservation code or, you know, whatever the code is that is underlying the decision. It has to be evidence that either supports or supports that the application meets it or supports that the application doesn't meet it. It can be on both sides. And what people typically think of when you talk about, you know, expert reports or those kinds of things, you typically think about somebody that's got, you know, an alphabet of letters behind their name, you know, either a PE or a accountant or, you know, an appraiser or, you know, those kinds of things that you tend to typically think about as being competent substantial evidence, but the biggest form of competent substantial evidence in this case is going to be the staff reports. So the staff reports by your professional planning staff is considered competent substantial evidence. So if the decision of the committee and the council is in support of what the staff says, then you really don't need anything else in your record. That is enough to support your decision. If you are going to go against the staff report, then you have to start thinking about what's in the record that is different from what the staff is recommending. So is there other evidence that's been supplied to us as the decision makers that we can use and that we would have to rely on in order to support a decision that's contrary to the staff report? And that's one of the reasons why in the memoranda that we send out for each appeal, always in there is a list of the criteria, because that's your roadmap, if you will. That's what staff uses in its staff report to come up with. They evaluate every single one of those, and they say, does it meet it or not? Does it meet it or not? Does it meet it or not? And then ultimately, that's what forms the basis of their conclusions. I'll let them turn in a minute to kind of how they get to that analysis and how they get to the recommendation. But for you as the decision makers, if you are, again, if you're going to go contrary to the staff report, you have to have heard something else in the record that goes to one of those criteria. That's the competent piece of competent substantial evidence. Does it relate to something that is one of our criteria that we can evaluate? And so if there's a lot of public testimony about we just don't like it, we just don't want it, we just are opposed to it, you know, we have it a lot of times with cell towers. You know, when a cell tower is being placed in some community, it's just a generalized objection to it. But they can't articulate a reason why. Okay, why do you not like it? And so, you know, from a council's perspective, you know, you've got the ability to ask questions of the people who are presenting before the council. Why don't you like it? You know, and if they can articulate something, good, then that's more leaning more towards what's called, you know, what the competent substantial evidence is. So substantial is a little misleading in that substantial doesn't mean there's more evidence on one side than the other. Okay, you can have a whole pile of testimony about one particular thing, and then one witness is particularly compelling that is saying the opposite. You can go with that. It's not a balancing act. Okay, so it's you as the decision makers get to evaluate the credibility of the evidence. You know, the credibility of the witness. Are they biased? Are they do they seem to know what they're talking about? Do they not even live in the area, so they can't really talk about traffic impacts and, you know, those kinds of things because they just wouldn't know that. And it may be that, you know, sometimes the expert reports that come in aren't credible for whatever reason. We dealt with that with the demolition request for the bank in Arlington. There was a lot of testimony. They had two you know, structural engineers, contractors, that said, hey, this building is in bad shape. There was a lot of time spent by the Historic Preservation Commission and even the city council talking about, okay, you don't have a license. You know, you're the realtor, so you're going to make money if this thing gets sold, you know, and you know, kind of targeting, if you will, the credibility of their reports. So, you know, so just because somebody, you know, submits something that seems to be have some expertise to it doesn't mean that you have to rely on it. You have to consider it, but you don't have to base your decision just purely on that. So so that's the first thing. Second thing is, as Mary mentioned, your decisions are going to be considered the final action by the city of Jacksonville, unless... ultimately, it will. I'll get to the unless in a minute. But ultimately, it's going to be the final decision of the city of Jacksonville, which means that the next step for the property owner, applicant, whoever lost, to do is to file a lawsuit in circuit court. Now, there's a difference between what the court's going to look at there versus what you guys will look at. So you guys, the posture of your hearing is what's called de novo. You probably heard that before, which means that you have the record of Historic Preservation Commission, Planning Commission before you, but you can also receive additional information. It's new. You can have, you know, you're not bound by the record that was created at Planning Commission or the Historic Preservation Commission. You can have new facts come in. But when it goes up to the court, it's strictly based on the record. They can't have new testimony, new evidence, new record, anything along those lines. And the judge cannot reweigh the evidence. So they can't say, I've got all of this evidence, I think it means this, whereas the city council thought it meant that, which means that, you know, I'm going to change what the legal standard is in those situations is, was there some evidence to support the council's decision? It's a very low bar. But I say this in light of the fact that there has to be some evidence. So, you know, if there is, if you are basing your decision based upon the number of red shirts that are showing up to the meetings every time and that, you know, there's a general, you know, we don't like this, we don't want this, you know, we're anti this, again, not considered competent substantial evidence. But if you base your decision on that, we're not going to win on appeal because there's not some evidence in the record to support it. Again, that's if you're going contrary to what the staff recommends. Yeah, the staff report is there. We win every time. Okay, so that's the importance of having competent substantial evidence to base your decision. And what we do as your attorneys in these cases is our job is not to influence your decision. Our job is to make sure that your decision is as legally supportable as possible.
I was going to raise that point. You know, the only thing the judge will consider is what's the process properly handled.
So the judge is going to consider three things. One, was due process afforded? So was there proper notice? Did they have an opportunity to, you know, to participate in the hearing? So if, you know, let's say hypothetically, we only give the appellant a minute to present their case, that's not going to be viewed as, you know, that'll be a due process violation because we didn't give you a reasonable opportunity to present your case to us. So that's why we work with, you know, the chair of the committees to talk about how much time is appropriate to give each party because we're worried about that due process argument. So that's first thing. Second thing is, did we follow the essential requirements of law? Did we apply the right standards? You know, if we, you know, we've got these nine criteria in a zoning exception, for example, but we based our decision on something that wasn't part of those nine criteria. We didn't follow the appropriate law, okay? And then the third thing is, was there competent substantial evidence to support the decision? So typically the first two aren't a problem.
Two out of three are actually procedural.
Two out of three are absolutely procedural.
Yeah, so we just need to make sure, and that's why Mary and others are so sticklers about making sure we follow the process.
Yeah, and so you might sometimes hear a question from the lawyer that says, okay, which criteria, you know, you're saying this is what you're using to base your decision on. Hey, you make a motion to grant the appeal, goes contrary to the staff report. Well, what did you hear? You know, I heard, you know, people talk about they didn't like the aesthetics of it. Okay, well, what criteria does that go to? You know, and so, you know, so that there may be some, don't think we're picking on you. What we're doing is that we're trying to, you know, make sure that, you know, whatever the decision is going to ultimately survive if it goes up on appeal.
Yeah, well, okay? You kind of cringe sometimes when with all due respect to our council members, well, the people don't want this. That is not
for the district council member,
you know, support.
You know, so we cringe when we hear decisions that LUZ made because that's the direction the district council member wants to take it in. That's not a criteria. You know, how does it, you know, to check the box if the district council member is in favor or not, you know, so... You know, so, you know, so we may, you know, pull some more details out or, you know what, we may be hearing, because when I'm participating in those appeals, I'm listening to what evidence has been submitted. So if I have a council member that says, well, the district council member doesn't like this, so I'm going to vote against it or I'm going to vote in favor of it, whatever, I have evaluated whether there's evidence outside of that that is in the record to be able to support it. So, you know, if I'm comfortable with the record, then I'll let that kind of thing slide. You know, if I'm not comfortable with the record, then I might say, okay, what evidence did you hear to be able to? Because the reason is because thumbs up or thumbs down is not the only decision that you guys have at council. You can actually remand it back to the commission. So if there's a particular thing that you want them to explore, and I'll give you an example. We had a demolition application come in for historic in Springfield. And one of the criteria is, did they market the property? What's the value of the property? Is there some other use that could be put to this? That hadn't been developed at all. And so there was back and forth about whether or not they really had an ulterior use to it or how firmly they really supported that or explored that. So they sent it back to the commission and said, hey, get testimony on this. And then it comes back up. So that leads me to the whole thing of, you know, you're back to the point of your decisions are the final authority or final action of the city. Sometimes they're not because you've sent it back to the commission. But it always comes back to you. So ultimately, you're the final authority. Okay. So that's that. What constitutes competent substantial evidence? We've talked about the staff reports. We've talked about expert reports. But it's really anything that a courts have said reasonable mind can accept as being able to prove whatever's in front of you. So it can be citizen testimony. It can be, reports about, you know, somebody did a study, you know, and there's gopher tortoises that are, you know, in this particular area. So, you know, you can draw in things like that weren't really specifically commissioned for, you know, for this application, but you can, you know, draw in other stuff as long as you guys find it to be credible. Is it something that you can rely on or that a reasonable person could rely on to support, you know, one of those criteria? And so a lot of times, you'll hear the lawyer stands up in front of you and the lawyer says this, 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 and this on the criteria. Lawyers' arguments are not competent substantial evidence. Reason being is because the lawyer is just mouthing something that they got from someplace else, right? They're not presenting a report. They don't have personal eyewitness knowledge of whatever it is that they're talking about. So, you know, people spend a lot of money hiring applicants or hiring agents, rather, to support their application. But at the end of the day, you know, what that person is telling you guys is not technically competent substantial evidence unless, again, they have personal knowledge of it. So that's one of the nuances that it's prevalent in the court cases about, you know, that this was nothing more than argument and it's not, you know, evidence that's in the record. So so that's, you know, one thing that's not competent substantial evidence. And so with that, I think, unless Mary, you had anything to...
Scott, go ahead.
Go ahead, but you're done.
Well, and with respect to competent and substantial evidence, I think one, you know, there are certain things that the citizens that come can, as long as it's not just as Jason said, we don't like it, we don't want it. If they come and they're speaking to the impacts on traffic, how bad is the traffic currently? You know, how would this exacerbate the traffic? Mm-hmm. Is it within the character of the neighborhood? Often you'll see that there's a criteria that speaks to that. They know the character and the lifestyle of their neighborhood, and they can speak to that with competence. And so to the extent that they're offering you those kinds of insights into the neighborhood and how it can't be speculative. And, you know, we think it's going to be X, Y, and Z. I'm trying to think of it'll drop the property values.
Yeah.
Well, that's purely speculation. But they can truly speak to the character of their neighborhood. They can speak to the traffic as it stands. They talk about accidents at intersections and their concerns that adding a business that's going to be of significant volume is going to create further traffic backups, traffic incidents, things like that. So there are opportunities that you have from citizen testimony, lay testimony as we call it, that can truly be applied as competent and substantial evidence. A lot, and to jump off of what Jason said earlier, we're listening to that, and there's a lot of emotion that comes through with these types of cases. There's a lot of emotion from the residents. It can find itself carrying forward on the dais. And so we know that when council members make this decision, they don't just make it from the criteria or what's in black and white on paper. They're making it from the heart. And so it's our job to kind of help your heart speak to those criteria that you have in front of you. And that's part of what Jason and I do when we're on the dais is part of relating it back. And so that's an important aspect, but it's also important that the public understands if they give that kind of testimony, it can be considered competent and substantial evidence. And it's tough when that doesn't happen. And so sometimes council members can, that our understanding of that can elicit better testimony but through the questions that they ask. And I've seen that happen before as well. Scott, you had a question?
Oh. I just want to ask a little bit about the hearings early on, because when I was on council, there were times that I would go down to the Planning Commission meeting and ask questions and try to better understand the legislation that was coming before us. And I know that we're not allowed to take a position at that Planning Commission meeting, so I would just ask you to talk a little bit about that. And then the time between LUZ and the full council, if you're not a member of LUZ, what are your thoughts about a council member taking a position at LUZ, even though they're not a member of that committee, and then going to full council?
Two good questions. So, and feel free to jump in, Jason. So with respect to Planning Commission, you're correct. As you did, and certainly today, council members can and do at times attend Planning Commission if they know there's something significant going on in their district. You're absolutely right. You cannot take a position at Planning Commission or at any time, or JHPC at any time before it comes before the council for action and has its public hearings. I do know that, you know, you all have to just kind of exercise your discretion as to whether you want to go to Planning Commission to ask those questions, because you do have the ability to speak to staff individually to ask a lot of questions, and that might present an opportunity where you don't kind of get sucked into the hearing. And I'm always cognizant that the presence of a council member at those hearings can sometimes at least get the commissions to really stand up and take notice, and and recognize that this is of significant interest. And that can be good or bad depending on the commissioners, but that's certainly within your right to do it, but as long as you don't take a position, because then you put yourself in the position of having to recuse yourself. The other thing I would say is if you're asking questions, you just want to make sure you don't sound like you're leaning into a specific direction or not, or trying to lead them to get you to a yes or no, whichever your preference would be with respect to the application. As far as the timing between land use and zoning and council, so our system is a little different than your traditional municipal government, because we have 19 council members and we do have the committee system. And most municipal and even county governments, you have a lesser number of council members, and they are the ones that are hearing the matter themselves. We're not bouncing it back to a committee for a recommendation and then bringing it back to council for final action. So our system is a little bit of a square peg in a round hole with some of the procedural aspects of how land use and zoning matters are traditionally handled. But as you are aware, Scott, and I know council members Clark Murray and Mr. Boylan are also aware, that the hearing that occurs at LUZ is in some instances the only hearing. So on appeals, it's the only true public hearing that would occur. And the Land Use and Zoning Committee is comprised of council members. And at that point, after that hearing is closed, they are taking a position because they are making a recommendation to council. So if a district council person or a council person who's not on the committee attends and sits through that hearing and receives all the evidence through that hearing, it's not different for them to take a position compared to the 7 members of city council that sit on the committee. And that's a little bit nuanced that can be confusing because that's not how you see it done in other places. But it's something that has worked for us, and it's something that's been upheld when things do get appealed into court. But it does put you all in a little bit of an awkward position sometimes. Some council members come truly just to listen to the testimony. They might give input, but they reserve the right to have take their position and opine upon something at council. And others choose to come, and they right then and there at Land Use and Zoning Committee give their position, and they say how they're going to vote on something, whether they like or they don't like. Either way is fine.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
I don't think we've submitted a nuance to that. We haven't seen it since Scott was president. All been at large since. Mm-hmm. But if Scott as president showed up, then it's a matter of his district. You could apply and vote there because he's a member of the committee, correct?
Sure, the council president's always a member of the committee. But I think what Mary's point was is even if you're not the council president, yeah, you're not a member of the committee.
Yeah,
you are hearing the same testimony that is right. Going to support the LUZ recommendation to the council.
Sure.
So, theoretically, I'm sure in practice every single time, you guys listen to all of the testimony at LUZ before the next Tuesday when you go to the city council, so you'll know what evidence, and that's what you use to base your decision on. That's no different if you listen to it over the weekend or whether you're sitting right there and listening to it. You're hearing the same thing that's the only thing you're going to hear to base your decision on, so that's the record. So, no, I don't see there being any problem at all with a non-LUZ member being at LUZ and stating their position on the record.
Oh, okay.
So I had a council member ask me this question. That's why I want to make sure to bring it up. And I kind of alluded to that's the direction I would go, but I urged them to speak to y'all.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we get those questions, and we always welcome them, because certainly on appeals, they don't come up very often, so it just depends on who's the lucky council member whose district it was
but
in.
But as a matter
And generally, just in general, these are the types of questions we love getting in advance because then we can walk the council members through it because it is a legitimate question. You don't want to assume after you've heard us sit up here and school you all about LUZ and the procedure and competent substantial evidence, you don't want to presume that you're not a part of that committee, that you're in a position to start talking about your opinion or your position and that you have to wait till council. That's actually something I get a lot.
My nuance to that, however, to your point earlier on, well, whatever the district councilman wants, I want to support. So if I come to a LUZ committee meeting and opine on it and saying, I don't like this one, I don't want to influence the vote of my colleagues because it's going to make it sound like, I'm going to go with the council member. It's his district. He knows best. And that's why I've always been reluctant to offer a position for or against any item that was up there that I was a member of.
Yeah,
I mean,
but you could take the position that I'm the district council member, my constituents are opposed to this because.
Mm-hmm.
That because, you know, has to be based on competent substantial evidence. So, you know, so if you're there and you hear, you know, the folks that are, you know, that have been, you know, individually sure. calling you saying this is going to increase traffic, this is going to be bad for our schools, this is, you know, whatever it is, right? You can articulate that,
sure.
you know. So, you know, what you can't do is you can't just say, well, I'm the district council member, so I'm going to, you know, put my thumb on the scale, you know, and use that as you know, weight to make the decision come out one way or the other. But in essence, you can participate just like an eighth or ninth, you know, council or LUZ member and have that input.
And I probably dropped the ball in that, Ken, when the 80 townhomes were going in within two blocks with 1,500 students that were going to three private schools or two charter schools and a private school with no public transportation available to them. It's a freaking nightmare.
But I do think your observation is legitimate, and it's a keen observation, recognizing that that does happen. Yeah. A council member can come to committee and say, I don't like it, and then that's it. And then you are absolutely right. That can often, there's a tendency to want to sway your vote to support your colleague. It's that because part that, you know, then it's our job to get to the because part.
Because I didn't go to the, like, I was at the LUZ, but I didn't comment on it. Had I done it there, it probably would have been a different outcome. Full council.
Can you talk a little bit about ex parte communication? I watch and I listen, and I'm not sure if everybody completely understands it. And so I just think it would be a great opportunity for you to share that.
Sure. So ex parte, from the legal definition of it, is just any out-of-court statement that's being offered to prove something. Okay. So how it applies to you guys is that it is it's also hearsay. But what it is it's it's all stems from the fact that these quasi-judicial hearings are supposed to be fair, okay? And that fairness aspect of it is, you know, going back to if it gets reviewed, that's part of the due process piece. Was it fair? And so that's the reason why you have to disclose ex parte communications, is because people have talked to you outside of the trial, the quasi-judicial hearings, and the other people that weren't a party to that conversation should know, A, that it happened, B, what was the substance of the conversation, and C, did it influence your decision one way or the other, okay? So, because that gets into the whole bias thing, right? So that's the whole reason for, you know, for ex parte. Now, there's, you know, people always ask about, well, I got an email, but I didn't open it. Is that an ex parte that I have to disclose? That came up at the last LUZ. No. I mean, you know, because there hasn't been a communication. You know, it's like, you know, somebody that, you know, wants to talk to you in the grocery store, and you're like, no, I can't, I'm busy, and I got to go. Well, that's an attempt to talk to you, but it didn't happen, okay? You guys are in 100% control over whether or not you engage in any kind of ex parte communications. So there can't be, there's a state law that says that we can't prohibit it. We can't say there shall be no ex parte communication as a systematic approach to how we're going to do it in Jacksonville. You guys are elected officials. You guys are responsible to your constituents, and therefore they have the right to access to you to talk about the issues that are important to them. So we can't have a prohibition against that. That being said, it's up to you as to where your comfort level is. You don't have to talk to anybody. You don't have to talk to everybody. You can only talk, you choose to talk to this person, but not that person. Totally up to you. But that's the reason why, you know, the whole ex parte thing is, it just gets back to that fairness piece. And does somebody or did somebody have influence because they got to you outside of one of these public meetings? And the other side should have the opportunity to know that it happened, to know that, you know, it didn't sway your mind or didn't make you make up your mind.
Well, and I'll add to that. One of the things that we are always cognizant of, and we did an orientation, and we try to remind our LUZ committee members specifically, but all council members, is why we ask for the type of ex parte disclosures that we ask for. So you do it in writing, but the verbal disclosures are, I would argue, somewhat, they're actually more important, because that's where your constituents and the public and the applicants are there to hear the disclosure. They're not seeing the piece of paper that you file with Legislative Services, although that's important for a complete and accurate record. But we're asking you to, you should be disclosing who you talk to, when you talk to them, and generally the gist of what you talk to them about. And the reason for that is that if you have an ex parte disclosure, the other party who disagrees or believes something else transpired has the ability to refute or rebut that disclosure as part of the process. So that's why it's important to get sufficient information on the record for them to really know what that conversation entailed, so that they can rebut that if they choose.
Because prior to the public hearing, then?
Prior to the public hearing, or as part of the public hearing, yes. Because the courts have said, if you have an ex parte communication, that creates a presumption of prejudice in the decision. And the way we offset that or cure that presumption is disclosing it as ex parte as part of the public hearing process. So that's why it's significant and why it's so important.
So can I just ask one more question? I'll stop after that.
That's why we're here, so you can ask as many questions as you
want. And I hope it helps others, is why I'm asking. So I was a part of a formal hearing a number of years ago as chairman, and it was really challenging for me as someone who is not an attorney. Thank God Lori Boyer was my vice chair, so she helped guide me through it. But it's the only time I've ever seen it happen in my entire time here. And so I'm not sure how we got to that point. I know the applicant requested it, but under what terms did they request the formal hearing, and what's different about that than a regular hearing? Obviously, that one took 12 hours, so it was a long hearing.
It's that's a good question. So the council rules outline the procedure for formal versus informal hearing. 99.9% of what you all have are the informal hearings. Those are the ones that occur every 2 weeks at LUZ and subsequently at council. So you are correct. The applicant has to request a formal hearing, and they have a certain amount of time to do that. I don't recall if it's 7 or 10 days in the council rules, but they have a certain amount of time to do that. And then you're right. It's a much more, obviously, based on the name, formal process. You're running it almost like you see judges have to run trials in the courtroom. And so you're swearing in witnesses, you have cross-examination, you have all the aspects of what you see, not just on TV, but in the courtroom. And it is so uncommon, it can feel very awkward going through that type of process. And I know the public also doesn't love that, because they have an ability to be cross-examined, and that's not something they're used to either. But you're right, it's very, very rare. Since my time here with the city, we've had one request that ultimately they did not pursue the application, so we never had the opportunity to do it. And I think your example is probably the one time Shannon Eller had one time that she had to do a formal public hearing, and that might have been the one that she was talking about.
So that one, I think the opposition requested a formal hearing, I think. They have the right to request it as well, right?
As an affected party?
If they're
truly an affected party, and there's a definition for that, then they can also request the formal hearing. And a lot of times you might find that occurs if there is an expectation that you'll see this get appealed. They're trying to establish a much more formal record in that kind of a proceeding. That doesn't mean that you can't appeal from an informal hearing. It's just... They're laying the groundwork now, anticipating that next step. And if it's highly contentious or there's lots of people and money involved, you can see that happen.
Thank you. Okay, so I think I'd like to turn it over to Aaron and Aramis to kind of walk through. An application comes in, and then ultimately you issue a staff report. But what are your steps? What's your process, you know, for evaluating whether or not to recommend approval with conditions, or denial?
Yeah, so the process between when we receive an application to when we issue a formal recommendation of either approval or denial, we're basing our decision off of the criteria of the application. So for the appeal process, these would be like zoning exceptions, waivers, and variances. So depending upon the criteria, we go through each question and answer it based off of our review. That review could consist of staff site visits. So we go out and look at the property, drive around, look at the community, neighboring parcels, and do that site visit so that they can have almost like feet on the ground and understand like what we're looking at and the community that surrounds it. That also includes reviews from different city departments. So we will send applications out to different departments, including like historic preservation, transportation division, traffic engineering. If we know that there's going to be concerns about the traffic of the area, we'll get these reviews from transportation or traffic engineering, maybe for traffic counts in the area, roadway capacity, and different interpretations from them during that review. That also includes maybe like Parks and Rec, JEA, airport officials, if it's in an airport zone. So JEA can sometimes give us information, our military representatives for the military airports. Duval County School Boards gives us information. We also have it reviewed by community planning to make sure that the request that's being made is consistent with the comprehensive plan and our long-range planning with the city. Sometimes it includes protected species reports, depending upon the acreage of the request. Make sure that we're not affecting any potential species in the area. Not all the time, but sometimes we do get a traffic study ahead of time. Traffic studies are not required prior to some of these applications just because of the fact that traffic studies cost a lot of money and take quite a bit of time, and a lot of the developers or applicants don't want to put in that money or time if they're not going to get the entitlement that they're looking for. Sometimes we get it ahead of time because they've already gone and done it, but we won't have that a lot of the time. And then after city department reviews, other information that we might take in are our city planners will attend CPACs to get information from them. Community HOAs attend those meetings. Citizens attend those meetings. They voice their concerns to the CPACs. Our planners take that information, and then we'll also pull information from our different departments. So again, if the citizens or the HOA members are saying that there's a significant traffic issue in the area, we can take those concerns back and run it through our different departments to pull the information that we're going to need to answer those questions and see if there is, you know, potential major traffic issues in the area.
Aaron, can we speak to that a little bit more? A couple of things with respect to traffic, more times than not. Some of the things are pretty cut and dry. Mm-hmm. You know, is it consistent with the neighborhood? We can see there's LDR. Mm-hmm. It's in the transitional, whatever it is. But traffic seems to be a common issue in the context of this process. I guess a couple of questions. Number one, once you start to hear people talking, public coming in talking about the traffic concerns, does that give you an opportunity to revisit that and have a more explicit response to that question? Because more times than not, when I look at the applications, is it an inference, you know, does it impact traffic? We don't think it's going to be a significant impact on traffic, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't assure me as a council member when I'm looking at this thing that you've given the kind of the, I'm not saying you don't, mm-hmm. but the report doesn't tell me that you haven't done that. I question whether the due diligence is happens as it relates to mm-hmm. specific, because traffic is, you know, is common time, top of the list for most people when they talk about these things.
No, so a lot of times when we get traffic concerns, it's usually due to the amount of density that's about to go
Correct.
Into the area and whether or not the roadways have the capacity
Right.
to handle the amount of trips that are going to be generated by that use. So during our review, we will have Transportation Division, who has the capacity reports for all city-maintained roadways in the city. So we will run the numbers of the units that are about to go into that area versus the capacity of the roadway. And many times that analysis will be included in the staff report.
Every opportunity to include it, I certainly would encourage it because it makes it a whole lot easier.
We can start doing that even with potentially zoning exceptions, especially if it's for uses of density.
It would help them and help us council members to be able to say, okay, you've given it the credence necessary to tell us. Comparative, we've got a 120-unit multifamily going in over here. Comparable situation over there with 120 or 140 created this amount of traffic, and we can use the comparative. I mean, just to be a little more less rote in terms of the response on all those things, I think would be helpful.
That's a good suggestion, and you'll notice, I think, when we do have land use and zoning amendments that come through, a lot of them are conditions, and a lot of conditions are traffic-related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that.
Because that is
a big deal.
Factor for people.
That would be the second question. Why not, at your point in time, when you see the process and say, this is going to be a little iffy, and require of the applicant to do? I mean, that's a policy change, perhaps, that we as a council should take up and consider as to whether or not to give you the leverage to require a traffic study.
Yeah, I think we just worry about the legality of if we can require them.
Maybe ask that question to Jason then, or Mary. How viable is it for us to be able to give them the latitude to require a traffic study?
You know, I think that, I guess let me ask a question first and then come back to that. So let's say hypothetically that so there's a condition in there that they do the traffic study, and that traffic study comes back, and it's going to be really bad. What happens? Because, the rezoning's already gone through, or the exception or whatever it's gone through, then what does that do as far as their ability to engage in the use that they got approval for?
So from conversations with transportation, these traffic studies are looking at the amount of, vehicle use or trips to the location that are going to occur because of this use. The results of the traffic study are, how are we going to mediate the traffic that's coming in? Like, does that mean we need to put in turn lanes, lights, right in, right out, or, right in, left only, entrance lanes. I mean, so the results of the traffic study are how to mediate those in regards to, putting in the maybe stop signs here or lights or anything like that. From what transportation has told me, there's never been a time that a traffic study has come back saying nope, you can't put this here.
Okay. And that's kind of what I thought the answer was, but so the impacts on traffic as far as volume is calculated on the front end based upon what the use is. So they have a formula that has been developed, I don't know where, but it says, okay, if it's going to be a liquor store, it's going to be or square footage retail, it's going to result in this many trips. So every time that they get an application in, they look at what the use is and they say, okay, how many trips is that going to generate? They do peak hour, they do off hour, they do all kinds of things, right? And then they say, okay, now we got to apply that number to the road system that's around it. And that's going to tell us before the approval is given, based on their recommendation, they know whether those roads are going to be able to handle it or not. Now, once that application gets approved and they're entitled to that, then they have to work with traffic engineering and say, okay, we know the roads can handle it, but from a volume standpoint, but what sort of improvements do you need to make in order to, you may need a turn lane, you may need a deceleration lane, you might need a traffic light, you might need, whatever, right? And so I think I think the analysis is already done in terms of if it's going to fit in this area. It's the second piece of it that you're asking about, I think, is how. How does it fit?
Yeah, and Band-Aids aren't going to solve some of the problems.
Without getting into the specifics of it, the Chick-fil-A is a good example because LUZ said, no, we want to see the traffic study before, not because of how many cars were going to be caused by this Chick-fil-A use, but where. Right. How are we going to handle the traffic created by this use? Because that was the issue there. Is it dumping it out onto a private road? Is it going through a community? You know, and so that's where, you know, to know the how piece of it makes sense.
Sure.
I don't think that's something that we probably need the answer to on every application.
But Aaron, I'm sorry, just real quick, and I'll shut up. So I know you've not. Well, I know you've been in the office a long time, but I mean, have there been opportunities or suggestions by your staff or folks or others to say, "Hey, look, you need to do a more comprehensive traffic study before we will give this approval"? Let the applicant an opportunity to show what they think they can do to address possible traffic concerns.
I mean, there have been times we've asked because, I mean, a lot of developers will say they don't have a traffic study, but they have gone ahead and done it because they are looking towards the future and, you know, they want things to move quickly as possible. So having a traffic study already done helps. So if we ask them and they have it, sometimes they will provide it to us, and that definitely helps us make a determination.
Well, in reverse the question then. Mm-hmm. So you've got a project and traffic, you know, and engineering tell you that this doesn't work. Do you ever tell the applicant, hey, look, you need to go do a traffic study to approve us or we won't approve it?
So it's the fine line of if we can require them to provide it to us beforehand. Now, if they don't, and we know we've received comments from traffic engineering saying that one of the biggest things is a school, especially like a neighborhood. We know based off of the site plan that you've given us that this is going to cause major concerns, and we will let the applicant know, hey, we've reviewed this. This is going to be a major concern. If you can give us anything or alter the site plan to accommodate more individuals on site, that might change our decision. But as of right now, we're going to have to recommend denial based off of that. Then we communicate to them prior to even getting to the public hearing phase.
Okay. I just wanted to state that we have about 6 minutes remaining in our meeting. So Ms. Abney, if you want to wrap up, and then we'll get to Mr.
So,
Wells.
So the only other information that we would really take in, CPACs, sometimes there's community meetings before a staff report's been made available. So if we're asked, we will attend and listen to the concerns of the community, take it back and review those concerns. And then we also receive letters, emails, phone calls from citizens. And so we take all that information in before finalizing a staff recommendation. I'm sure the procedure is very, very similar for historic, but I'll let Aramis add anything else that he has.
Yeah. All right, so I'll try to be brief here. But, again, Aramis Wells, Historic Preservation Section. So our main attempt, I mean, before we even start writing our staff report, is to preserve, protect, and rehabilitate historic fabric of structures. So mainly when we're doing these staff reports, we try to work with the applicant as much as possible to come up with some type of reasonable solution to whatever they're looking to do. So try to work with their scope of work. And so just even looking at the memo here, let's say, for example, it's a re-roof. And so our main approach to any application whatsoever, we're evaluating each application and each building as a respective individual building itself. So on the other side of things, for land use and zoning, they're looking at approaches to the regional effect, how compatible it is whatsoever. But for historic, and I cannot emphasize this enough, is that we're looking at each building as a character-defining feature that stands in its own respects. So you can't, you know, look at the next door neighbors and say, well, they replaced their roof or they replaced their windows and we're trying to match it. And I think that does come up a lot in the council. So it, obviously in terms of the criteria, we have the general code criteria. So that's chapter 307. So that's the historic preservation and code protection criteria. But we also have a set of guidelines that are accompanied with those historic districts. So namely speaking, Riverside as well as Springfield. So the design guidelines, those are a supplemental source, but they get into the architectural and aesthetic standpoints of things. So they have a lot of pictures, and they get into more what's common within those two districts itself. So in terms of evaluating our staff reports, again, besides looking at the scope of work, we'll look at documentary evidence. So we'll look at what we refer to as a Florida master site file. So that's a survey that was done for each property within both historic districts that analyzes its architectural character-defining features. And what we try to do, again, for any scope of work, is we try to make sure that what they're doing does not detract from historic features of the building itself, and what they're looking to do mimics it but doesn't necessarily, again, detract from it. So besides that, we'll look at records, we'll look at permitting. We may route something to zoning if we get new construction. One common appeal that you may see too, besides maybe a re-roof, is demolition. So we're looking at evidence that the applicant has made every reasonable effort to preserve the structure. So that may come up in the form of maybe transferring the property over to another prospective buyer. It may come up in the form of an engineering report. So that's something that we'll look at, and especially for engineering reports, we'll try to make sure that they're articulating to the best of their abilities that this structure cannot be salvaged. Looking at the criteria too, I mean, again, for the memo that's included, the criteria is really descriptive, but again, we're trying to make sure that the fabric will not be destroyed, and that every reasonable attempt is being made to mimic what's already there.
Mr. Wells, I'm going to interrupt for a moment. I'm trying to make sure I ask a general question as opposed to a specific question in regards to any particular situation. How is the historic aspect triggered? Do typically homeowners or the owner of the property come to the planning department and say that, hey, I live in this historical district, and so I want your input as to what I should do with my home, whether what I want to do is within the allowance, or how is the historic aspect normally triggered?
Yeah, so in terms of that, I mean, at the local level, we have two different routes you can go in terms of a local, what we refer to as historic designation. So you can do a local historic district. So that's usually a collection of homes within a regional geographic boundary. That's less common because that requires ownership support, and you usually have to trigger, I think, 60% in terms of votes. The last one we did was Riverside, and that was in 2008. Passed, I should say. So St. Nicholas is another one.
Hold on. What I'm asking is that I already know that where I live is a historic area.
Yeah.
And I want to do something to my home. How does your department typically find out that I want to do something to my home? Is it through the planning, the permit? Or do homeowners normally reach out to your department? That's what I'm asking.
It can be a combination of both. So sometimes homeowners will contact us, but any work that's done within a historic district or landmark, it requires a certificate of appropriateness. So because these properties are in historic districts or landmarks, they're flagged within the permitting system. So sometimes homeowners may not know, but it'll be flagged in our building inspection division, and they'll reach out to them to tell them that they need a COA. Or sometimes the homeowner may contact us prior to that, and we'll work with them to submit that.
The HOA will get.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that's what I wanted to bring up too, is that, you know, we struggle with that because people show up and they say it's usually after the fact getting approvals, right? It's, I didn't know, right? And so one of the things that you all need to understand is, first of all, there's very active between Rapp and Spar, Riverside Avondale Preservation and Springfield Preservation and whatever, Architectural Council?
Yeah.
Anyway, Spar, yeah. That are very proactive in educating the residents that are over there. The other thing that not a lot of people know about is when you buy a property in a historic district, you actually have to sign a disclosure when you buy it that you are acknowledging that you are in a historic district. And so that's part of the real estate documents that come across when somebody buys. So that's like, we don't really try and feel too sorry for folks to say, I didn't know I was in a historic district, but we try to put whatever safety nets we can in there. Every time you come up with a permit, not everything that requires a COA requires a permit, and so it's kind of trying to be proactive in educating the communities to know.
Before you touch down real quick, I wanted to, during my time in LUC, we saw a number of historic preservation appeals. I can't tell how invaluable the minutes of the historic preservation meetings are, and that's really the only bite of the apple we as LUC get when it comes to us as an appeal. We haven't sat through the entire conversation, so I found myself using your minutes, very diligently to making determinations as to where I stood on a particular issue. Thank you.
So thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you so much from your various departments. I appreciate you being here to answer our questions and to help us learn a little bit more about the appeals process. I don't know if it's typical, but let's give them a round of applause for their expertise, and thank you so much. And, of course, if you have additional questions, that they're always available to answer your questions.